local station board election, or contact your local election supervisor, Kathy Kidd, at les_kpfg@pacifica.org, or call her at 281-668-8854.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender community. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Valinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
Brian Levinka.
Summer Iman.
And Glenn Holt. And, Jack, what do we have on the show this evening?
Well, and I got to apologize. I did not update the website because I'm a little bit under the weather. But I know Summer will be working on it, as she is just so good at it.
She's typing away at it right
yes.
now, in fact.
Well, we're supposed to have Ernie Manous on for the first segment to talk about Pride, but he's not here. So we will talk about Pride the best we know of it. Some of the stuff is sketchy because it's not quite as public as it used to be. The second segment, we're going to be talking to David Carter, who wrote the wonderful book about Stonewall, and they're in the process of getting a documentary out on either in the theaters or on PBS. I think it's PBS they're trying to work on. The second hour, we're going to be talking about the new head of the LGBT Resource Center of the University of Houston. And then we're mandated, although this is really a good idea, any show that's an hour or more here on KPFT must talk about the upcoming KPFT elections. And we will be talking about that. And the whole reason for that is that KPFT, Pacifica Radio, is sort of a ground-up type of organization. That means that you, as a listener sponsor, or as a volunteer, which we're considered staff, even though we're unpaid, and the paid staff, which is a small amount, actually get to elect local board members who then elect national board members and sort of keep the power within the community of what Pacifica is all about. So that's coming up, plus This Way Out and stuff like that. And this is Pride Week.
And yes, it is.
It's sort of very exciting because Saturday is the parade. If you're not in the parade, certainly KPFT is looking for some people to join in with them. So you can call the station during business hours and say you'd like to volunteer because it's a really good experience. And what's neat about the KPFT float, it's the whole sort of crazy KPFT community.
Yes.
I was on it last year, and it was crazy the whole time.
Yes.
Yelling and screaming the whole
because KPFT has been part of this community for a long, long time. So that's something you do. The parade, and we can just talk about Pride. We can move right into that interview. We were hoping to have a representative from Pride Houston, as I said, but that didn't quite work out. So we will sort of do the best we can to talk about what's coming up.
Well, we're proud enough, and I guess we're gay enough to cover Pride.
Yes, know? We're gay enough. We're proud enough.
Well, I think your best source of information, if you're on near a computer right now, is pridehouston.org. There's a listing of events.
Well, but the publications, including the Montrose Gem and Outsmart magazine. By the way, Outsmart has a wonderful new website,
and that's the official Pride guide. So we should probably refer to that.
It has the event. Well, Pride apparently does not sponsor all these other events, or co-sponsor, or help promote them like they used to. So the Outsmart magazine has been doing this for a number of years, that anybody's doing an event during June that is related to Pride, if they know about it, and they work really hard to find out all these events, basically publicize that. There's a whole bunch of things that went on. Last Saturday was the gay men's course, and they had Kate Clinton, which I didn't go to, but I just can imagine. Kate Clinton is just absolutely fabulous. Pride itself has a number of fundraising events that happen in June. There's a dinner thing that happens on Tuesdays?
It's every Wednesday, and the next one is at Lorenzo's at 6 p.m. on the 23rd, which is Wednesday. And that is on Washington Avenue, 4412 Washington Avenue. It's a new place, it's a Mexican restaurant.
Oh, okay.
So it's called Lorenzo's, and it's Dine with Pride.
The other thing that Pride does is the Pride Idol stuff, and I'm not sure where that takes place.
This is the last one. I think they've actually crowned their idol. I'm not quite sure. I'm sorry. The Pride Idol finals are 10 o'clock on the 24th, which would be Thursday.
Yes, Thursday.
Yes, and Joy Guerra. Host that, and he's been on our show before.
Yes.
That's 10 o'clock at Meteor Pride Idol Finals.
So be there.
Be there. And that's they've kind of been having this idol-like competition for several weeks, and now it's down to the nitty-gritty. And the winner will go on to fame and glory upon the stage at Pride.
And an interview on Queer Voices.
Yes. And then that brings us to Friday. What do we have on Friday?
Well, on Thursday, the community center is doing a Lawrence celebration.
Yes, celebrating the. It's at on Thursday, and it is for the Lawrence v. Texas commemoration and presentation, and of the scholarship they've been working on, the Tyrone Gardner Scholarship at the center.
And what time is that at?
That's going to be at 7 p.m. at the community center.
Which is 3400 Montrose.
That's exactly right.
Suite 207. And in case you don't know...
what is Lawrence versus Texas? Maybe our listeners don't
know. Well, and if you listen to NPR, you certainly know that these are the last weeks of their session of the Supreme Court as they're wrapping up. So there's been a bunch of decisions coming out in the last couple weeks. Well, in... how many years ago? Does it say how many years ago? That happened
in 2003.
So
2003, this happened. There was a case in front of the Supreme Court from a person, two people, although the case was actually one of the two, from Harris County, who basically the Supreme Court said that the sodomy laws are illegal.
That's
now,
right.
What's really strange is that in 1986, there was a case that came out of Atlanta, Hardwick, and it went the other way. So I was certainly very nervous about that, but of course, Ray Hill just knew exactly how all the justices were going to vote. And I think that it was probably really good that it happened that year, because who knows how it would come out today, as we're seeing a whole bunch of these court cases come out that are just really, really screwy. Especially that one about campaign finances, where basically
corporations now can buy candidates.
Yes, and of course we're getting out of the subject of Pride, but actually in that year we had an incredible celebration, because that decision came out like on a Thursday, and then we had an incredible celebration that Saturday of Pride, because it overturned the sodomy laws in every one of the states that had it. And even though the Republican Party platform right now wants to bring that back, and basically wants to, you know...
Well, they want to do a lot of things.
Yes.
To our community.
Turn us back.
And Hispanics.
Criminalize the gays.
Well, and what happened in the decision of Lawrence, it decriminalized being gay.
And they just want to make that a law again? I don't understand the reasoning. I mean, how...
Well, perhaps we could ask. Do you think they would answer us?
I don't think they would.
Yeah.
There is a log cabin organization in Dallas, and of course there's a gay Republican organization here in Houston that we may be able to bring on. And, you know, and I know, in fact, it was interviewed on KUHF today, that the log cabin president in Dallas did his best to try to stop that. But they basically, there's no stopping them when they wanted to do that. But getting back to Pride.
Yes, let's get back to Pride.
Saturday is the big day.
Yes.
The festival starts at noon, and that's over near, I was going to say Blockbuster Video.
It's,
but
it's not Blockbuster.
Or Hollywood Video.
Hollywood Video.
Neither one of those places are still there.
It's over by Schlossky's.
It's over by the Tower Theater.
It's Westheimer between Commonwealth and Yoakum.
Yes, and it's an all-day, and it's a free festival. I got to give them credit for that. They made it free. One of the great things that they continue to do is they have an air-conditioned tent that has history in it. And basically, the two groups, which are GCAM, the Gay...
Gulf Coast Archive.
Archive and the Botts Collection, will both have sections in that booth and show off some of the artifacts of the past and history. Because, you know, I think there's some people talking about how Pride has sort of moved away from the history. In fact, there's a couple websites out there and a couple sort of movements talking about Take Back Pride. And one of them is based in Dallas, and I think one of them is a little more national. We may talk to them in the future at some time to see what their viewpoint is. But there will be plenty of booths. Now, we never got any really press releases about exactly what's going to be there, except that Walgreens is going to be in there, and they're going to do some testing, I believe.
Yes.
Which is, I got to give them credit for that, because and there's going to be a lot of community organizations there and some businesses that are interested in the community. And then, of course, the big thing is the night parade. And the night parade's been going on since 1997, and it is probably one of the most fun parades in the city. And apparently this year, it's going to be a little bit different.
How so?
Well, from my understanding, is they're closing down two of the outside lanes of Westheimer. So the barricades will be, basically there will be two lanes in the middle that will be the parade. And I'm real interested to see how this is going to work.
Well, that's going to be close quarters.
Does that mean there's more people on the sides of the parade?
Well, I think that's the hope, that people could spread out more on the streets, and there would be more room if people want to move back and forth. There's been a real problem with people crossing the street during the parade, and, you know, we had that incident last year with the police horses, and hopefully that will not happen this year.
So I guess the thinking is if you give them more room on the sides, they won't be trying to cross.
I guess that's the thinking there. And because Denise will be, you know, she's one of the featured grand marshals of the parade, that, you know, it should be relatively a big parade. We'll see how that goes out. I think the numbers are down like they were last year because of the economy. I don't know how many professional floats are going to be in there. They didn't talk about that at the mandatory parade meeting. They're not going to have banners this year because they, apparently the banners that we've had over the past number of years, there's two problems with them. One is that they're falling apart after all these years. Two is they actually were out of compliance. The other change that's going to be happening is they're not going to allow people to throw stuff from the floats. Now, in the past many years, we've had throws of, like, you know, stuff like plastic stuff and sort of Mardi Gras type of stuff, and they think that has been a problem. And in fact, it's sort of really not legal to be throwing stuff from cars in Houston. So what they're going to allow is people to be handing stuff out along the parade route,
which makes it where they're closer.
We'll see how that works
out. You just said there are barricades, so that's going to be
Well, the people will hopefully be behind the barricades, so you can pass things out to them as you're walking.
People go crazy for stuff.
It's amazing.
Those, you know, a third of a cent bead chain.
Or if you have anything that glows, I mean, people will kill themselves to get those things. It's crazy.
I always enjoyed being a wheel walker, because that way you're real close to what was going on and all
of it. It's kind of scary, because people, it's like a mass of people coming at you, and you're trying to protect them from getting run over. And
that's what's really important. A wheel walker, if you don't know what that is, someone that walks right beside the wheels, so that if someone should fall or stumble, run out and fall and stumble, you're there to pick them up or pull them out from underneath the tires, because the drivers usually cannot see them.
They can't see, and it's a parade. They just keep going.
So it should be a lot of fun. It starts at 8:45 p.m. down near Montrose Westheimer and Woodhead, and moves east towards downtown, and it goes past Westheimer. Hopefully, it's going to be a great turnout.
Do we have any indications on weather yet?
Well, it's a little bit early on that. It's never rained on our parade. Actually, that's not true. It did rain one year on our parade, but that's after the parade started. But for the past, since 1980 it is, our parade has never been rained out. And a lot of people complain about doing the parade on that last weekend of June, but somehow the gods have been real kind to us. I mean, there was one year where Rainbow was yelling, it's 100%, 110% chance of rain. The weather guy, who was actually Dan Metter, who was out there, says, it's going to rain, it's going to rain, it's going to rain. But somehow we have been incredibly lucky over all the years.
Is it a coincidence? I don't know.
Well, do you remember a couple of years ago, maybe it was longer ago than that, there was, right before the Pride Parade, there was a beautiful rainbow in the sky over Westheimer.
Yes.
That's also happened like during Easter, too. It rained, and then a rainbow came out, and then everybody went to the bayou.
We've sort of been lucked out. The last daytime parade, which was in 1996, started at 5 p.m., and I was really upset with the person who said, we ought to do it at 5 p.m., because, you know, usually it was done about 2 or 3, and we did it at 5 p.m., and how did we luck out? Because it stopped raining just about 4:45.
How did people used to do the daytime parade? That was the March of Death.
It was. because the reason we did that because it's the traditional Pride weekend. That's when Stonewall happened, and most of the major cities that are next to other major cities, like St. Louis, not L.A., San Francisco, New York, Chicago, Atlanta. Now, Atlanta had some problems a couple years ago because their festival, which was just, I understand, an incredible festival, they had to move it out of their Piedmont Park, which apparently they just had that whole park because of the drought. So they had to move it downtown to the convention center, move it a week later, which was the 4th of July, and apparently the cost just was so much higher because of having to hire people working in the convention center. It almost bankrupt them. But, you know, lots of Pride committees have had their sort of, you know, year that things just didn't work out.
Well, by far the best decision Pride has ever made was to go to a nighttime parade in Houston. That's brilliant, and we're all rejoicing that it's going to be at night this weekend.
Now, did you say what other cities have nighttime parades?
Well, the city that started it was actually Sydney.
Sydney, yeah.
And when it was really interesting, because I actually did an interview with that, the Montrose Star, I believe it is, and they asked me those questions, and it was rather interesting because back then in 1995 when we started talking about this, before the internet really caught on, Lee Harrington did a lot of correspondence with the people in Sydney and talked about why they did it. Actually, they had no choice. They almost had their own Stonewall riots to have a parade, and their parade had to be at night, and it's in the downtown area, and I've seen videos of that parade, and it's the most incredible thing because they've got all these different choreographical, and it's called the Gay Mardi Gras, mm-hmm. and it's the largest event in Australia, and it happens in February, March, because the seasons are opposite,
right.
And I just, you know, we got lots of help from them, and, you know, we were very, very concerned about doing that night parade, whether it would be safe, whether the people would do it. Some of the bars were really against us, and in fact, it took a number of years for some of the bars to say, you know, this is a good idea, because now we get, you know, because the parade doesn't stop until like 11:30 midnight, and they were really concerned about their Saturday night business when everybody was in town, but in reality, what happened was it gave them a whole weekend of Pride rather than just the Sunday and people having to go to work the next day. So it sort of hampered on really building up the festival, but I do think it was a great decision.
Now, how did the city react when they were first approached about doing that?
Well, that was a concern. You know, would number one, would we get insurance? Would the city allow us to do it? And this is back when Anise was on council. So the first 2 years of the parade, it actually 97 and 98, we had to shorten the parade length because that's the way the ordinance was written, that the parade started at Mandel rather than Woodhead. And so we sort of made it work, but it was awfully hard to line up those floats along Mandel because there's more businesses mm-hmm. along there where we've been very lucky with the mm-hmm. school on Woodhead
Lanier
School. So after 2 years, we sort of worked behind the scenes, and we got the city to change the ordinance for us to be able to do that nighttime parade in the length that it is now.
You know, the cool thing about the whole lining up of the floats is the neighborhoods behind Westheimer, and all the people that live in those houses know that once a year, you're going to have crazy people in your streets, in your yards, and it's kind of a given that you live in Pride District.
Well, I haven't been involved in the parade in 4 years. Well, 3 years. The past 3 years, I haven't been involved, running it, whatever. But we worked really, really hard to communicate with the neighborhood, communicate with them. And the most important thing that Pride did over the years, and at the beginning it was us, on Saturday night, Sunday morning, we went out there and cleaned those streets. Now, the city cleans the actual streets, but we went out there and we cleaned the sidewalks, and finally we were able to afford it to hire somebody to do that, and we really stressed to all the people over there in the lineup area to leave that area as clean as possible because, you know, we're part of this neighborhood and we really wanted the neighborhood people to have a good time, and a number of people along that lineup area have parties.
There's like little house parties from and everybody just kind of goes and floats between each little party, and you know, you can't even buy a house over there now without thinking, oh my gosh, what am I going to do in June? You know, it's kind of been known for that.
You travel out of town if you're not going to join in.
Well, you know, the floats are built on site, like starting in the morning. That, you know, that's exactly. Saturday, so it's like an all day affair.
Yes, and especially the professional floats. They get out there like at 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, and the guy who does, you know, sort of has the business, Sam, I keep thinking keeper, but he's the voter registration person in Houston, but Sam Parker, and this is not an advertisement necessarily for him, but he runs this thing called Parades, etc. And actually, there's a really interesting story that in the early days, there was another guy who owned the company. And, you know, Larry Bonnaries, who was one of the founders of the early parade, basically talked about how he, you know, because he came from New Orleans and he really sort of wanted to do a Mardi Gras thing and do these incredible floats. Well, this guy was really mean to Pride, and we later found out it wasn't that he was anti-gay. He was just such a perfectionist that if these floats weren't perfect, he was just not in the greatest mood. and that was a really interesting thing to learn. And then he sold the business, and this new guy took it over, and you know, there are not a lot of people who build floats. And we also have a lot of the organizations sort of buy parts of the float, the you know, undercab or stuff like that, and they do their own stuff, like the Crew of Olympus. So there's this real combination of our own community having its artsiness and craziness and bizarreness and being able to. But now it's expensive to buy a float. It is expensive. So
it's not cheap. But
so I understand that. It's difficult to do that. But we were, you know, the first year the night parade happened in 1997, at that time the parade started at 9 p.m., and as it was getting dark out there and the floats started lighting up just before they were ready to come out in the street, it was just this most magnificent thing that we had sort of like done it. You know, we sort of figured out how to do a really good parade in Houston, Texas, for our community. And, you know, our parade sort of has a rivalry with the Art Car Parade, because that's another really neat parade, as being a very fun, very artsy type of parade. And, you know, in fact, there have been art cars in the Pride Parade over the years.
You know, I would make the argument that the Pride Parade pulls more people in from a larger area than the Art Car Parade.
Well,
we're kind of a magnet, I guess.
Yeah, and you know, no downsaying of the Art Car Parade, because they pull in people from, I mean, they got a really nice write-up a few years ago on the front page of the New York Times, and they do some great stuff on, like, the week before. They have their cars going out to schools and stuff to show the kids, and we can't quite do that, because that would be considered recruiting, I guess. But
the Republicans would think that.
Yes. But we, you know, the part of the Pride is the educational, where we came from, the celebration of the Stonewall riots in 1969, which we'll be doing in our next segment, of how it's so interesting that that happened in 1969. And then in 1970, there was probably four or five cities, and I may not have this right, but I believe it was, definitely it was New York and Boston, Chicago,
LA,
Los Angeles, and San Francisco, and I think San Diego, if I'm not mistaken. They did a parade in 1970. Mm-hmm. And how that has grown, that we have Pride events, you know, sometimes parades, sometimes picnics, sometimes, you know, just a mixture of those. And if you go to interpride.org, they have a complete calendar, well, as complete as they could be if they get the information from the groups around the country. I mean, there are events in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and Wichita, Kansas, and speaking of Kansas, Oklahoma, actually, Tulsa passed a non-discrimination ordinance for city employees, passed by the city council this past week. And it's just like,
yes,
wow.
I saw that in the news.
Wait, we need that here.
Boy. Well, absolutely. Absolutely.
Wait, Tulsa can't
pass.
Well,
we're not as progressive as Tulsa,
Oklahoma.
Oh,
my gosh. Oh, my gosh. That's crazy. Okay, let's kind of recap. Can we recap our events for the weekend?
Surely.
We kind of get Pride. Well, I think if you see an Outsmart, grab one of those. That's the official Pride guide. And there's a whole calendar of events and descriptions, and I think there's websites and everything.
Well, you can go to OutsmartMagazine.com.
Yes.
They have a great new website, and I really got to give them credit for that, that has the Pride calendar of the events that they know about that's going. A lot of them already passed, but there's still events going on this week. PrideHouston.org is the official Pride Houston organization's website. There's information there. There's even a way you can volunteer. I believe they're still accepting volunteers. If if you're interested, because that's a good way to sort of get involved in the community and see what's going on. I mean, I did that in 1982, and it really...
And look where you are now.
Yes, look where I am now.
You know, one thing we didn't mention was the Laramie Project. They were on the show last week.
Yes, they were.
And they did a powerful reading, and I would highly suggest going and seeing that. That is at produced by Theater New West at the Holocaust Museum on Caroline Street, and that's going until Thursday. No, I'm sorry.
It goes
July.
Past, yes.
It goes past the Pride.
Okay, on the website I'm looking now, it goes to July 24th, and that's an amazing story, and check it out.
Okay, so PrideHouston.org or OutSmartMagazine.com, or I believe the Montrose Gem. I'm not sure whether their website is up yet, but they're available. You can pick up these magazines around the community, and you can find out what's going on, and just have fun, because that's what it's about. It's about fun. It's about being empowered and educational where we came from, and so we just continue on, because this is the biggest event in the entire state that happens here in Houston at the end of June every year.
And we're celebrating this year. We had an awesome historic election, and we're going to come together and celebrate that.
We have Anise Parker as our new mayor.
Absolutely.
So you're listening to Queer Voices.
I'm Sherry Lunn.
And I'm Michelle Pleasant.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending June 19th, 2010. Do state laws banning same-gender marriage in the U.S. violate the fundamental federal constitutional rights of lesbians and gay men? Or is marriage, by definition, an institution that drives procreating heterosexuals into stable unions for the sake of children? Those were the basic questions addressed during closing arguments on June 16th in the closely watched federal trial challenging California's Proposition 8 before presiding Judge Vaughn Walker in U.S. District Court in San Francisco. Voters passed the constitutional amendment in November 2008, 5 months after the state Supreme Court's marriage equality ruling. Lawyer Ted Olson, representing a gay couple and a lesbian couple in the case, known as Perry versus Schwarzenegger, argued that Prop 8 violates, among other things, the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause by creating separate classes of people with different laws for each. He said that the state had rewritten its constitution in order to place same-gender couples into a special disfavored category where their most intimate personal relationships are not valid, not recognized, and second-rate. There is not a compelling governmental interest to put the plaintiffs in a class like this and take away what the U.S. Supreme Court has called a fundamental right, a right of liberty, privacy, association, intimacy, and autonomy.
Representing the forces behind Prop 8, lawyer Charles Cooper claimed in his closing arguments that sexual orientation is not fixed, referring to its amorphous, effectively indefinable, at least consistently, nature, and the simple fact that it is not immutable or an accident of birth. He also argued, though his assertion has been demonstrably disproved by historical records, that the central purpose of marriage in virtually all societies and at all times has been to channel potentially procreative sexual relationships into enduring stable unions to increase the likelihood that any offspring will be raised by the man and woman who brought them into the world. And Cooper noticeably raised eyebrows in the courtroom when he said that you don't have to have evidence to prove that the purpose of marriage is to bear and raise children. During the trial in January, he told the court that he didn't know how same-gender marriage would hurt heterosexuals, and that he didn't need to know in order to win the case. At the end of the day, responded Olson in his rebuttal closing, I don't know, and I don't have to present any evidence, with all respect to Mr. Cooper, doesn't cut it. In their final written filing, the band's sponsors also urged the judge to revoke recognition by state agencies, courts, and businesses of the marriages of 18,000 gay and lesbian couples who wed before voters passed Proposition 8, saying such an order would honor the expressed will of the people.
Judge Walker's ruling will almost certainly be appealed by the losing side, and most observers believe that the Prop 8 case will end up before the U.S. Supreme Court as soon as next year, after a stop at the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Walker is expected to issue his decision within the next several weeks.
A series of incremental rights advances for LGBT people seem well-timed by the Obama administration with the traditional U.S. Pride Month of June. The Department of Housing and Urban Development announced on the 7th that it would require applicants for funding to comply with state and local anti-discrimination laws that protect LGBT people. A statement issued by HUD Secretary Sean Donovan said that, "We're using every avenue to shut the door against discrimination. 21 states and the District of Columbia ban discrimination based on sexual orientation, and 12 states and the District of Columbia protect transgender people. According to the Human Rights Campaign, at least 373 U.S. counties, cities, and towns ban anti-lesbi-gay discrimination, and 132 of them also ban anti-trans discrimination." The U.S. Department of Justice issued a legal opinion that gays and lesbians who've been abused by their partners should be protected under federal domestic violence laws. The opinion references the Violence Against Women Act and clarifies that victims of same-gender domestic violence should be safeguarded by the 1994 law. The memorandum, which was produced by the Department's Office of Legal Counsel, provides that criminal provisions related to domestic violence, stalking, and protection order violations apply to conduct when the offender and victim are the same sex. And the U.S. State Department on June 9th issued a statement saying it was pleased to use the occasion of Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgender Pride Month to announce its new policy guidelines regarding gender change in passports and consular reports of birth abroad. Until now, trans people had to have undergone gender reassignment surgery to get an identity change. Effective immediately, the statement said, when a passport applicant presents a certification from an attending medical physician that the applicant has undergone appropriate clinical treatment for gender transition, the passport will reflect the new gender. Sexual reassignment surgery is no longer a prerequisite for passport issuance. The new policy is based on the standards of the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, which the State Department said is recognized by the American Medical Association as the authority in this field. National Gay and Lesbian Task Force Executive Director Ray Carey applauded the policy change, noting that transgender people need to be able to travel and live with identity documents that accurately reflect who they are. But a U.S. Food and Drug Administration committee has decided to retain current rules preventing men who have sex with men from donating blood. They've been banned from doing so since 1977, reinforced by the start of the HIV/AIDS crisis in the early 1980s. The panel held hearings last week on the issue and voted 9-6 against making any immediate changes. Several lawmakers and the American Red Cross had called for reconsideration of the policy. Heterosexual men and women who've had sex with someone at risk of HIV must only refrain from donating blood for 12 months. LGBT advocacy groups condemned the panel's decision. Medical advances since the ban went into effect allow experts to properly test blood donations for HIV, but the virus is undetectable for 2 weeks after it's contracted. The committee acknowledged that gay and bisexual men were being treated unfairly, but said there was still a tiny but unacceptable risk of HIV transmission to blood recipients. The panel's proposals are only provisional, however. Senior executives at the Department of Health and Human Services and the Food and Drug Administration have the final say on any change in policy. The UK has similar laws rejecting gay and bisexual men who want to donate blood, although they can still donate their organs. France and Germany maintain lifetime bans, as does Canada. But the Canadian Blood Service is suing a sexually active gay man for lying about his sexual history in order to donate blood. Kyle Freeman is countersuing, saying that the policy violates the country's Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Australia, Japan, and Sweden have one-year deferrals for men who have had multiple male sex partners, although activists in Australia and Sweden have strongly lobbied for a lifting of those restrictions. Spain and Italy screen blood donors based on the safety of their sexual activity rather than the gender of their partners. In other news, Statistics Canada this week said that the number of crimes motivated by the victim's sexual orientation more than doubled from 2007 to 2008. 71 incidents were reported in 2007, but increased to 159 in 2008. 75% of those hate crimes were described as involving physical assault or verbal threats of violence. And the country's leading LGBT rights organization, EGAL Canada, says that an estimated 3 in 4 hate crimes against LGBT people go unreported.
Its executive director, Helen Kennedy, called for improved diversity education in Canada's schools.
The government of Puerto Rico is launching a special committee to examine the island's recent rash of hate crimes against its LGBT residents. In announcing the formation of the committee this week, Attorney General Guillermo Somoso Colomboni also said that the information it develops will help design policies to assist victims of such crimes. The new panel will include representatives of the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Juan, police officials, and Puerto Rico's Civil Rights Commission. According to Pedro Julio Serrano, a spokesman for the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, at least 25 murders of LGBT people in his native Puerto Rico have been motivated by the victim's sexual orientation or gender identity since a law was passed to establish harsher penalties for those crimes in 2002. One of the most recent high-profile murders was of 19-year-old Jorge Steven Lopez Mercado, who was beheaded and partially burned in November. Family friend Juan Antonio Martinez Matos confessed to the murder and was sentenced in May to 99 years in prison.
And finally, a painting soon to be on display in Dublin is drawing outrage from Roman Catholic Church officials and laypeople in Ireland and around the world. The controversial but critically acclaimed 49-year-old artist Kevin Sharkey said it was inspired by recent comments by Pope Benedict XVI labeling LGBT people and legal recognition for same-gender couples dangerous threats to humanity. Sharkey called those remarks an outrage and a disgrace. He told the UK's Pink News that he'd worked on the painting with acclaimed Italian artist Alessandro Tessi, adding that, "We were passionate about doing this work." The lifelike portrait in a cathedral setting shows a well-dressed male couple standing before a broadly smiling pope. It's called You May Now Kiss the Groom.
That's News Wrap for the week ending June 19th, 2010. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. You can read the text of this week's News Wrap online at www.thiswayout.org. For This Way Out, I'm Sherry Lunn.
And I'm Michelle Pleasant.
This is Queer Voices.
Well, it is Pride season, and
oh,
it's
yes,
also
it
summer. It is summer. Can you believe it's summer?
Oh, I noticed.
Oh, summer.
The longest
here.
Day of the year today.
Yes, yes. Like here summer in Texas, we wouldn't know it because it's been summer for 2 months. the living is easy, as they say. On the line with us is David Carter, who did this fabulous book on Stonewall, which, you know, I'm not a big book reader, but that one I did read cover to cover because I learned so much. And it was just, David, I believe you spent like 10 years working on it. Is that correct?
That's right. 10 years total.
and it was like every stone was turned over to talk about what went on. And, you know, and I haven't seen the book in a while, but I still remember so many of the incredible details of like the Village Voice writer being across the street from Stonewall as he was writing a story. And there's so many things. Well, now I understand that this book is going into a film. Is that correct?
That's correct. Probably most of your listeners will be familiar with the American Experience series on PBS, and a little over a year ago they acquired the documentary film rights to my book for a basis for an American Experience film. And the film was finished early this year. It's called Stonewall Uprising, and I'm really happy with the way it came together. First of all, it's going to be an hour film, then they extended it to an hour and a half. And it was judged successful enough. It's actually being released in theaters now.
Great.
That's wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you.
So when is it going to play on the, is it going to play on the national network at a certain time? Is it scheduled?
Well, it is. What I understand is that it was going to play on PBS this past April, but because it got theatrical distribution, the last I heard is that was moved back to April of 2011.
Oh, okay, great,
yeah.
Great.
But they started out with about, you know, I don't know, 12 theaters, and now it's in about 37 cities, either in theaters or in film festivals, from Tulsa, Oklahoma, to Finland, from I decided they added a new city in Canada. So I think the film, one of the remarkable things about the film is that it's done on such a high level in terms of production values. For example, if some of your listeners have seen a lot of the Ken Burns films,
yes,
most of those were shot by his cinematographer, Buddy Squires, who is the cinematographer
wow.
for this film. It's in high definition. It has about 55 soundtracks mixed into the audio. It's just a gorgeous, beautiful thing.
Well, and how, I mean, it is one thing to do all the research and write a book and be able to get the interviews and stuff like that. It's a little bit more tougher to get the video interviews and get some video footage, although there are some great scenes in the movie Milk at the beginning of showing people being beaten and dragged out of bars. So how did you get, you know, how did you get the video?
Well, that was done, well, two ways, really. A lot of that was found, the archival footage was mainly found by the researchers who were hired by the filmmakers. And in doing so, they turned up new photographs from the Stonewall riots. Those were published at the time of the 40th anniversary a year ago. They were found in the New York Times archives. They were
wow.
the sixth night, the sixth and final night of the riots. And we never had any photographs beyond those made the first and the second nights. They turned up some amazing, for example, like public service advisory announcements from the 60s showing, you know, various typical portrayals of gay people. The whole idea of, you know, older males preying on young boys. They use 67 CBS reports. It's called a CBS reports, I believe is the correct title. The Homosexuals.
Yes.
With Mike Wallace.
Yes.
But I think, you know, although I worked in many ways on the film, I think my greatest contribution really was that because was my simplest, because I had been interviewing these people for
yes.
10 years.
Yes.
I knew who could tell the story and who was reliable and who had good, interesting stories to tell. And as I was interviewing the people for my book, I kept on thinking, wow, I am so fortunate to hear these stories from the people who lived this. And
well,
I wish other people could have the experience I'm having right now sitting in this person's living room. And it was my fantasy that a documentary film would be made. And so now, you know, people can hear the story of the Stonewall riots told in the voices of people who were there, people who were patrons of the bar, people who were there that night. You know, early activists from the gay movement. It's just a wonderful thing, and it's preserved for all time now, and it's done on the highest production level.
Great. And, you know, it's really interesting because they just started this group in Houston about, you know, digitizing the history. And they were talking about they're actually going to be doing some interviews. In fact, I'm in one of the interviews. But, you know, when people interview me or somebody else, we don't always remember the exact date when stuff happened. So you have to do the research. And in fact, there's a story about the year they had an elephant in the Pride Parade, and they found this picture on the back of the picture. Somebody wrote the year, and that was actually wrong from what they did the research. So I'm sure you had to do an awful lot of, like, finding. And it's not necessarily that people are lying. It's just that their memories don't quite exactly match up to when this stuff happened.
That's right. I did I was very careful. One reason it took me so long, Jack, is that, you know, there has been controversy about who was really there and who wasn't.
Right.
And
sort of like Woodstock.
I'm sorry?
Sort of like Woodstock.
Yes, yes. So I tried to be extremely careful about how I collected my data. So I asked people, you know, questions. I did very extensive interviews with my subjects, interviewing them as extensively as I could, trying to get everything I could out of them in terms of their memory, probing them, prodding them. But then I didn't tell other people what other people had told me. I didn't tell them conclusions I had formed.
Right, yes.
So that, you know, somebody else said something back that was repeating what somebody else had told me. It wasn't published anywhere. Then, you know, by techniques like that, I was able to be sure that I had reliable witnesses and so forth.
Yes. So you were very much involved in it, but you also had a lot of experts who knew how to do film.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I mean, you know, really what I'm talking about just now was primarily the work on the book.
Right.
But then that benefited the film because they knew what subjects to go to, and I also knew, you know, what documents there were. In other words, whether it was a newspaper report or a police report. And I also sort of, when they were looking for other material, I think, well, you know, this person's an expert on, you know, gay television and radio, and this person, there's a good collection there, they should ask this person, you know. So, yeah, I mean, without a, you know, good documentarians, without, you know, this expert cinematographer, really good, you know, the expertise of WGBH was very important too. They have very high production
yes.
values for the American Experience series, and you know, a film is always a collaborative work, I think.
Yes. Did you have any problems in getting the rights for certain of these archival footage?
Well, I didn't really work on that, but
okay.
I don't think that that was really more between the filmmakers and WGBH and the people who own the rights. But I do not think I never heard that was presented any real difficulty, because you know most of this. I mean, you know, we didn't find any footage of the Stonewall riots. That would be the Holy Grail, right?
Sure, sure.
But what the footage they relied on was mainly two things. Because they did not find any footage of the Stonewall riots, and I told them I thought it was possible they might find some, but I didn't promise them anything. They did some recreations, but in a very careful way. From my point of view as a non-documentarian filmmaker, it seems that, you know, film documentarians don't believe in recreations. I don't see the point of that. I don't think that if a recreation is well done, there's nothing wrong with filming a recreation, whether it's, you know, the Battle of Gettysburg or an event in World War I where you don't have much film footage. But that is out of vogue among filmmakers. And what they did is they took people to a bar or to an empty building that was more or less, they felt like, the inside of the Stonewall Inn. And then they took blurry photographs, film footage, and also still photographs, and then they did an interweaving of that footage they created along with archival footage, which was generally of riots from the 1960s and demonstrations from the 1960s.
Since you wrote the book and since the film was done, were there people we lost?
Well, there have been some who have died since the book was done. For example, you know, one of the few people we knew who was arrested the first night, Dave Van Ronk, has died of cancer. Yeah, a number of witnesses have been lost. One person had a very severe stroke, so he's still alive, but he's not able to give interviews as he could and speak as he could before. And then some of the people who were in the film, actually two of the people who were filmed for this American Experience film, were since the filming diagnosed with very serious illnesses.
Okay.
So you know, it's not just a matter, of course, of a question of a person being alive, but also are they able to give an interview?
Right, exactly. Well, you worked 10 years on the book, and then you spent time doing the film. Are you sort of like stonewalled out?
Well, put it this way. I'm extremely happy the film is out. I'm quite happy with the film. But I'm also ready to get back to my next project, which is a biography of Frank Kameny, the main militant in the movement before Stonewall. And I'm looking forward to the simpler life of a writer as opposed to somebody who's working on a film.
Well, great. Certainly, you know, you were concerned that when the book came out, it wasn't really reviewed as well as it should be for being such a dynamic storytelling of what happened that time. And, of course, there's less book reviewers out with the way things are changing, and we certainly lost a lot of our GLBT bookstores. I mean, you know, it's great that some of these mass bookstores have sort of GLBT sections, but they're not quite the same of having the large sections of what we do. In fact, I'm not even sure there's any of the stores left.
Well, there are some. There's a Giovanni's Room in Philadelphia,
okay.
for example, and there are several others. I'm sorry, I can't think of the names off the top of my head. But you know, speaking to the point of the book not being recognized, when the book was not much reviewed outside the gay press, what it made me realize is that our movement for equality is not seen as civil rights history nor as American history.
Interesting.
And that, I think, is the most exciting thing about this film. First of all, that it's made by American Experience and PBS gives it a certain cultural imprimatur and validity. And it's also gotten into theaters. So my hope is that the American Experience series, having made this film, on the heels of the success of the feature film Milk, there's now an opportunity for the history of this movement to be woven into the tapestry of American history. And I think we have to really make it a demand that our history be seen as what it is. It is civil rights history, and that, actually, I think we should make it a political demand of the LGBT civil rights movement that our history be included in American history, whether that's in a textbook, a survey book, a museum. I tell you what, because I said this in a speech I gave on the 40th anniversary, a curator approached me. He was doing an exhibition for the Museum of the City of New York on John Lindsay. So he asked me who he could talk to in the gay community who could talk about, the gay movement under Lindsay. And they actually incorporated, I pointed them to two people. They did interviews with them. They got material from archives. And they created a whole small section of the exhibition now that's about gay history under the Lindsay administration.
And we should probably explain, John Lindsay was a Republican a mayor in New York when Stonewall happened.
That's right, yes. He was a mayor for about 4 years before and after Stonewall, approximately 8 years. So, I mean, some of the most important aspects of the LGBT gay movement, gay rights movement, occurred in his city during his administration. Now they come back to me and they've asked me to put together a panel on gay rights during those entire 8 years as part of, to happen at the Museum of the City of New York as part of this history. And I think this is what, if we reach out and we say this over and over, I find that when I say this, gay audiences react and non-gay audiences react. When you put it that way, that this is civil rights history, it's human rights history, it's American history, it's got to be integrated, people get it. And
right,
so,
except in the state of Texas, where they basically sanitize the history books of things that they don't want in there. So,
well, okay, we have our, ultra-right-wing enemies,
yes,
who are not going to be moved by any rational argument.
No, yeah, but when they remove even the founding fathers to promote Confederate heroes.
At least we're in good company.
Well, really do appreciate the good work you did on the book and really telling the story as it was and the 10 years in putting it all together. I congratulate you.
Well, and I hope your film does get to be played here in Houston. It's sometimes tough because we really only have two theaters that play independent films, but right now Proposition 8 is playing downtown, so that's an interesting film, and there is somewhat of a film festival that's trying to re-energize here, but it's going to be great that it's going to be on PBS nationwide next year, because it's going to be able to reach, hopefully some of those stations won't not play it, but it'd be able to reach an incredibly wide audience, and PBS does absolutely some great stuff.
Well, yes, and now when they create American Experience Film, they create a website for each film. So my understanding is there will be a permanent website up about it. The DVD will be available. WGBH, which is the station in Boston where American Experience comes out of, they are planning a two-year outreach campaign around this film.
Wow. Oh, that's wonderful.
And WGBH is probably the biggest, PBS TV station in the country. They just do incredible work.
Yes, Nova, for example, also comes out of there.
Great. Well, we wish you... Now, what's the name of the film again?
Stonewall Uprising, and my book has been reissued, paperback with a movie art tie-in on the poster and so forth. It's also, oddly, it came out, although it's paperback, it came out and had the best version of the photographs therein. So, people want to know more after seeing the film. My book is still available. That Stonewall, the riots that sparked the gay revolution.
Great. And do you have a website?
Yes, www.davidcarterauthor.com. We can find out more information on the Stonewall riots and my other adventures.
well, great, David. I really appreciate you talking to us right, you know, during Pride Week when, because there's sort of this movement that's starting up called Take Back Pride. And I've seen a couple websites, although I really haven't delved into it. And I think there's some concern by some people that Pride may be turning in, well, there's always that concern, Pride turning into parties and not really, you know, focusing on the history of where we came from. And we'll explore that in future episodes here on Queer Voices. David, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, and I wish a happy LGBT Gay Pride to everybody in Dallas and Texas.
And Houston. And Houston.
Houston.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
Proud. The name of the group is Sugar Beach. That's from 2008 and their album Not Deserted.
So
Celebrate spring with the Discovery Green Thursday Concert Series, co-sponsored by 90.1 KPFT-FM.
Okay, the Discovery Green Concerts have been, like, totally cool, and, like, we really hope you haven't missed it. Okay, so, if you've missed the Discovery Green's Concert Series on Thursdays, you have, like, really, really missed out. But you've got one more chance. I mean, like, whoa. Because it's going to be, like, totally, totally way cool. Okay, like, we have Joe King Carrasco with David Beebe and the Comrades. You really don't want to miss it. You gotta come down. Thursday, June 24th. It's like totally the last one.
Bring your picnic blankets and lawn chairs. Don't forget to leave the glass containers and alcohol at home. Don't worry. Food, wine, and beer are available at the Lake House Restaurant. Visit kpft.org for more information. You've been listening to KPFT Houston.
Listeners support KPFT in many different ways. Some write checks and others use credit cards. But if you're spinning your wheels looking for a tax deduction, think about donating your working but unwanted car, motorcycle, boat, or truck to KPFT. You'll qualify for a tax deduction and at the same time take care of that unfinished business. To make a donation, call our toll-free vehicle donation hotline at 877-308-2408. We'll arrange for your vehicle to be picked up and the title transferred. Then we'll send you a receipt for your tax deduction. It's that simple to support the station you've come to rely on for alternative music, news, and public affairs programming. Again, for more information or to make a donation, call our toll-free vehicle donation hotline at 877-308-2408. You're tuned in to commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston, radio for peace.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way.
And this is Jennifer Renee. And we have a special guest tonight, Lorraine Schrader. And she's the new director of the GLBT Resource Center at U of H, main campus. And welcome, Lorraine.
Thank you.
And let's see, how long have you been in this position? It's brand new. They just formed it, didn't they?
Right. I just started on May 3rd.
And what are the responsibilities of the Resource Center, of the director?
Well, our goal is to create an environment at U of H of inclusion and acceptance for the LGBT students and staff and faculty also. So we'll be doing programs and events and so forth that support that goal.
And where is it located on campus?
It's in the University Center on the second floor, room 279A.
Where is the resource? Where is that? I mean, I've been out there. I always have to have a map when I go to an event out there.
Right.
Because I know, again, other than for a very short period of time, I didn't go to U of H.
Okay. The University Center is located right across the street from the Hilton, if you're familiar with that.
Yes.
And it's on University Drive. And we're on the second floor of that building.
And as far as the Resource Center is concerned, what does the center offer? Someone comes in and they're LGBT and they're on campus, and what are the resources available to them?
Well, the different types of programs that we have, first of all, we have something called Cougar Ally Training, and that is for staff and faculty, but also for student groups. It's like a sensitivity training so that they become familiar with GLBT issues and individuals. And what this program does is the participants, after they go through the training, they get a placard that says Cougar Ally, and it's rainbow and it has their name on it. And then as we get the word out to students to recognize that placard, they'll know that somebody with that placard in their office is likely to be GLBT friendly, and so they can be more themselves around, you know, a person with that placard. So that's one of the programs that we have.
I'm familiar with the Aggie Ally program at Texas A&M, and I'm curious It's similar, especially since there's quite a few students that went through the ally training. Is that also true at University of Houston, or is it mostly faculty? Is it offices?
Right now, it's mostly been faculty and staff that have gone through the training, only because the training started about a year ago, even though the Resource Center just started about a month and a half ago. There were several people from different departments that got together, and we did a little bit of research and investigated other schools and what they were doing for their training program, and then we put together our own. And currently, we've just, I think there's been about 70 people that have gone through the training. A few of those are students. It was very difficult for the committee to expand the program any more than what they were doing, a couple of trainings per semester, and we really wanted to focus on faculty and staff so that they would have that diversity training and being to be able to deal with the GLBT students. But now that I'm in the position, we do plan on offering that to student groups also.
What has been the response from the staff and teachers?
Very positive.
I mean, seeking the training.
Very positive. The people who have gone through it, they do an evaluation at the end, and we've had nothing but very positive responses from them. And we give them the option at the end to also have their name listed on our website as a GLBT-friendly, you know, ally, and 99% of them, you know, are willing to do that. So it's been a very positive response.
I would wonder about the 1%. Why would they not want to go through all of that and then not want to be recognized as someone who's sensitive?
I can't speak for them, really. I don't know.
That I always wonder, you know, in generally speaking, I would think that most people who would be going through it would be grateful to know that, you know, I've learned this, I want people to know. And then the few that would still not want to. That's interesting.
Sometimes people are a little bit uncomfortable. They feel like if they're considered an ally and people know about that, then LGBT students are going to come to them with all these problems and they don't know how to handle them. So they might back away from
that. But that's why there's a resource center, right?
Yes.
The whole point of the resource center.
Right.
Out of curiosity, is like what is the kind of... I don't want to say political, but what is the climate on the campus as far as gay acceptance is concerned? Is there a fairly generic acceptance of GLBT students, or is it
I'm not sure what you mean by generic, but I can say that the climate as far as acceptance of GLBT students and staff is pretty much reflective of society in general. It's not like overly friendly, but it's not overly unfriendly either. And that kind of during freshman orientation, which goes on all through the summer, different departments on campus that offer students services have tables available for students to stop at and get information. And I have a table at the orientation. And so it's very reflective. I have some parents who are bringing their son over. Come on, you need to take one of these brochures. And then I have other parents who are yanking their children away from the the table. And so, you know, you have that mix of people. And the same with the students. Some will come up and really excited. Oh my gosh, this is great that this is here and they want to know all about it. And other students I had this one student tell me, oh, I was raised Republican. And so he walked away. So I have a big mixed response.
So when they come over to give them the information, what sort of information or resources do you have for them?
Well, I have my brochure, and it tells about the different services that we offer. And some of the other ones that we offer that I haven't mentioned yet, a mentoring program. And just so you know, this is going to start in the fall. I mean, it hasn't really started yet. It's summertime. And the mentoring program is just going to pair LGBT students with other LGBT students to help those in need navigate U of H or navigate the coming out process at whatever degree that that person might need at the time. So that's the mentoring program that we're going to have. We also are starting a lending library where we're going to have books and DVDs all on LGBT issues. And so students will be able to, and staff and faculty, to check that material out for their own personal use, but also faculty will have access to that if they want to use anything in the classroom. Also graduate students doing research will have access to that also. Now, keep in mind, the lending library right now is very, very small because
The items to be lended out, are those donated to the resource center, or is this the campus itself, the school, paying for those?
It's going to be both. We are having a grand opening, and
when is that?
The grand opening is June 30th, and it's at 6:30, and it's going to be at the LGBT Resource Center, and Council Member Sue Lovell is going to be there to kind of say a few words and give us her blessing, I guess. And so we're giving people in the community an opportunity to bring items, either new or used, that they want to donate to the center. So it'll kind of give us a kickstart, I guess. And I do plan on doing some fundraising to be able to purchase additional resources.
Well, put that out there that you need some. What sort of things would you want? Are you looking for?
As far as books or DVDs?
Yeah.
Like I said, it's very small right now. We don't have very many resources at all. So really, anything that anybody has, whether it's fiction or a documentary or, you know, books on sociology, you know, that have to do with LGBT, whatever. We're open to all of it.
So roughly how many students would you be serving? I don't actually know how many students go to U of H, so, like,
it's about 37,000 students.
Okay. And so figure, you know, between, like, 5 and 10% of those would be GLBT?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's a... you know, a rather nice proportion of, or not, there would be quite a few students that would be interested in your services.
Right.
How are you guys getting the word out, other than through programs like this?
Well, I haven't really done a whole lot to get the word out yet on campus, except for I bought a great big sign.
for freshman orientation, right?
Yes, and we are in the University Center, and that's where freshman orientation is. And the University Center also houses a lot of the restaurants, and students just kind of hang out there, and there are a lot of events there. So our sign will be seen, and so that's one of the ways. Other ways are ads in the Daily Cougar, which is the student newspaper, advertising some of our services and so forth. I also have a strong relationship with Global, which is the student organization on campus, which is different than the Resource Center. The Resource Center is an actual UH department, and Global is the student organization. Anyway, so they have a very active membership where over 40 people come to their meetings every week, and so the word will get out through them also.
The question now, and knowing a little bit about it through my dear friend Maria Gonzalez,
right? Okay.
It was having a resource center was long in coming. It's been somewhat of a journey to get U of H to recognize the need and then put forth the effort and create this center. Do you know any of that history?
I've only been at U of H for 3 years, and during that time I have been on what we call the Cougar Allies, which is the committee that Maria Gonzalez kind of heads up.
Right.
And we advocate for GLBT rights on campus or whatever. And the whole time that I've been there, they have been working on somehow creating a resource center, going down different avenues. And I know that it had been going on for years before I got there. I can't say exactly how long, but I know it was a long time. And then one day, they just said yes.
Well, now, you got picked for the job of director. Tell us about the journey to that. How did you, they just put a post something saying we're looking for a director and...
Well, no, they posted the position like any other UH position, which goes up on their website, and it has to be posted for so long, and then people submit their applications, and so I did, along with other people, and they picked me.
And what your credentials? You said you've been at U of H 3 years. What have you been doing?
At U of H, I had two part-time positions, which worked out well because I dropped one of them because a director position is also a half-time position.
Right.
And what I was doing is, the one that I'm still currently doing is I work for Learning Support Services. I'm a learning strategies counselor, so I help students with study skills. I do workshops and counsel with them individually. And our center also has tutoring, so... That's what I'm still currently doing along with the director position.
Well, that's something important, too, because access to tutoring for some of the students who are having difficulties. That's excellent.
Right. I love that part of my job also. So hopefully we'll have a very good connection with the LGBT Resource Center and Learning Support Services where I can refer people. A lot of times people are not aware of all of our services, so I'll be sure to get the word out about that.
We're speaking with Lorraine Schrader, who is the new director of the University of Houston GLBT Resource Center. How would they directly find you? Or find the organization? Do y'all have a website or an email address? Or what's the phone number?
I can give you all of those.
Well, then do so.
The phone number is 713-743-3662. The website is not up and running yet, but I do have the URL.
Well, let's get it out there.
Okay. It's www.uh.edu, which is the main number for U of H, and then just / LGBTRC for Resource Center. I also have a Facebook page, and it's facebook.com/uh.lgbt.rc. And I'm using that kind of as a communication tool until the website is up and running.
So anybody that happens to have a Facebook site can go. Is it a friend site or a join site?
It's a fan page. So anybody can join.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's great. Thank you, Lorraine. We've been talking with Lorraine Schrader, U of H's new director of GLBT Resource Center. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And this is Queer Voices.
Miracles, miracles, I've been living. Miracles, 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 I've been living. Miracles, miracles, miracles. This is Queer Voices.
Celebrate spring with the Discovery Green Thursday Concert Series, co-sponsored by 90.1 KPFT FM.
Okay, the Discovery Green concerts have been, like, totally cool, and, like, we really hope you haven't missed it. Okay, so, if you've missed the Discovery Green's concert series on Thursdays, you have, like, really, really missed out. But you've got one more chance. I mean, like, whoa. Because it's going to be, like, totally, totally way cool. Okay, like, we have Joe King Carrasco with David Beebe and the Comrades. You really don't want to miss it. You gotta come down. Thursday, June 24th. It's like totally the last one.
Bring your picnic blankets and lawn chairs. Don't forget to leave the glass containers and alcohol at home. Don't worry. Food, wine, and beer are available at the Lake House Restaurant. Visit kpft.org for more information. You've been listening to KPFT Houston.
And we're on back here. This is Jennifer Renee.
And Summer Iman.
And we have on the phone with us Bill
Crozier.
Crozier? Would you pronounce that for us, Bill?
Crozier, but Hey You works too.
Oh, okay. it's I-E-R at the end, right?
Right.
I'm sorry. I have that sort of air. Okay. And you're on the board, our right. KPFT board.
That's right.
And we've got some elections coming up, don't we?
We sure do. Two out of every 3 years, we elect half of our board. And so we have, just like the other four stations in the that are part of the Pacifica Foundation, we each elect our local station board. Been doing that for about the last 8 years or so. And we want to encourage everybody who's a member to consider and who's listening to the show to consider running for the board.
Now, what are the requirements for running for the board?
The only real requirement is you have to be a member, which means you have to have donated at least $25 in the year ending June 30th, which means from July 1st of last year till June 30th of this year, or donated at least 3 hours of volunteer time, and that be supervised by some staff member here at KPFT. Of course, we want people that have a passion for public radio. We like people who would like to be to help make the station stronger, who can help us get more listeners, who could help with outreach, fundraising. There's lots of different things to do, and just want to encourage all the listeners of the show to consider running for the board.
Now, as far as a board member is concerned, what are your requirements as far as how much time do we have to put in? Did y'all meet several times a month, once a month, and what other hours you might put in?
Well, our local station board has a monthly meeting. In fact, everybody can come to that, even if you're not on the board. They're always open to the public, almost always.
When is that?
The third Wednesday of each month in the evening. And the location's been changing a little bit from month to month, but they're always posted on our website at kpft.org. And before I forget, you can also get information on the elections by going there. Go to the KPFT website and look for the link for elections.
So if someone wanted to, you know, get into this position on the board, you know, what awesome powers would they have of the station?
Okay. Well, we are... there's several things that the local station board does. I guess perhaps the most important is we elect four members to the national board, which I'm also on now this year.
Congratulations.
And that's the real governing body of the Pacifica Foundation. But the local station board also reviews the station's budget each year, which we're in the process of doing right now. And that really is what determines how money is allocated, what's spent on what. And if there's any priorities to be determined, that's where it's done. And then it goes on up to the National Finance Committee and the National Board also before it's approved. And, of course, we also review the station management each year. We're involved in fundraising, outreach, various other things. We have a strategic planning group, which has been meeting from time to time, and we just talked about that at our last local board meeting. We're going to be trying to get that going again because we hadn't really finished our strategic plan. And this is a really good opportunity for people to have real input into what we want to do to help make the station stronger. Our first goal that we decided on during our earlier planning stages was to increase membership by about a factor of five within 5 years. And so that's a pretty ambitious goal, and it requires a lot of other things that we'd like to do, too. But we want more people to hear programs like this and learn about them, as well as, you know, becoming members, of course.
So what are some goals that you guys have actually achieved? You said that you wanted to increase the membership by so much in 5 years. What have you overseen that has come to completion?
Well, we haven't. You know, we've kind of just gotten started on that. Actually, that was one of a number of goals, and you know, we've been working with our station management to work on some grant application. For example, one of them is for marketing, and I think that I worked with our development director pretty closely on that, and some of our other board members also have been working on other ways of increasing income, including off-air income. So that we can hopefully reduce the length of fund drives, you know, it still allows us to grow. If we're going to have more listeners, we're going to need more staff to accommodate membership, and to get more listeners, it's also going to take more promotion. And that's one of the things I'm really interested in. And I think that every board member should be helping with that to some extent, telling people about their favorite programs and helping get the word out. Because, you know, there's so many people in the Houston area and even outside the Houston area who could listen either through our broadcast or online and don't even know what programs we have on.
Well, and that's the case because so many times, you know, for me, I've been doing this for 4 years, and I go out and I'm on KPFT, and they look at you, KPFT, and you hang on.
Right.
It's, it's so disheartening. Then I give them the education and tell them when it's on, and but the only show they'll know is the one I talked about at that moment, and I give them the website, and also one of the things is I tell them about the archives.
You can
listen to any program for at least 60 days, I know, by going to archives and just pulling it up in the time slot. So you can never miss a program if you don't want to.
Yes, and it's a real hidden treasure. And some of the shows I listen to almost exclusively that way because they're not on at a convenient time for me.
Well, for so many people, you can, if you're on your computer, all you do is just click radio, go to the archives, and pull it up and play it in the background while you're doing something else.
That's right. And nothing you can do if you're not interested in certain things like what we're talking about right now, you could just skip right through it.
They're going to be very interested in this.
Or you can back it up and listen to it again. That's true.
That's right. You know, what did he say? And they back it up and hear it. Yeah.
Exactly. But something I really want to emphasize, too, is that we do need people who have a passion for helping KPFT get stronger and get more listeners and fulfill our mission. We have an educational mission. We're a 501c3 educational foundation. And, you know, we take pride in that we provide programming, news, music, public affairs that people cannot hear on the commercial stations or even on the other nonprofit stations. And we'd like to, you know, make more people aware of that. You know, there's so many people out there that are addicted to Fox News and Clear Channel and things like that, and we'd like them to know that there's other media out there, and
there is enlightened. There's enlightened radio programming.
Right. So it's a really great opportunity, and one of the nice things about the board too. I mean, you know, we don't always agree on everything, of course, and we all have different priorities, even of ways of accomplishing the same goals. But it's really great getting to work with people that are really passionate about KPFT and about sort of an antidote to corporate media, and helping us to bring material, you know, information to people that they don't get to hear anywhere else.
Well, and two, going back to marketing and getting the word out, KPFT is that jewel that people just don't know about. You can hear and listen to programming you'll not hear anyplace else. And, of course, in Houston, Texas, our show, Queer Voices, and then, of course, Jimmy Carper's After Hours, the only two LGBT programming in Houston.
That's right. Exactly.
And you can only hear it here.
Yes. And, of course, we have lots of other programs, too, that have different kinds of material on them. And also some of the others talk about GLBT issues, too. But yeah, you asked earlier, I forgot, I believe it was Jennifer and I that asked how much time does it take, and I forgot to answer that. But
yes, that was me. I always like to, when they say, would you like to be on the board? Well, how much time is it going to take?
Right. So, well, it's a lot of it's up to how much commitment you want to make. We'd like to have people that are really committed, but we understand, you know, most people have lives outside of KPFT, and whether it's work and family and whatever else, we meet once a month. We expect all the board members to be active on at least one or two committees. Some of us are active on several committees. Most of those committees meet at least once a month. Sometimes they have work groups or other, you know, smaller, you know, even sometimes just one or two people working on a particular project or a particular activity in between the meetings. And so that depends on what you're interested in. We have a number of committees, and they're all listed on our website. If you go to the tab that's labeled about KPFT, you can dig around and find out more information about our board and our committees. And the committee meetings are listed on the website, too.
Well, I have to correct myself from just a statement I made a moment ago. We do have Lestopia, which is a new program on KPFT. So there is a third program.
Oh,
GLBT program, yes. So
when is it on?
I caught it one time. I'm not sure if it's a regular program or not. I got the impression that it may have been on at least a couple times.
Okay.
And I just caught it, you know.
Do you remember what day it was on? Okay.
No.
We don't know.
but apparently it exists.
Well, you know, just a reminder, everybody, you can check the program schedule.
Check the programs. That's exactly right. If we've just given you the name of a program. Now you have the challenge to go to the website and look at the programming list and
right.
See all of it.
Or well, you I'm certainly going to look it up because we have open journals also, and sometimes there's programs that happen occasionally there, sometimes just one time. Sometimes we have sort of pilot programs to test them out and see if people like them, and if the people producing them want to do it on a regular basis.
Well, I know that,
and the board gets involved with that a little bit too. We don't have, you know, as much emphasis on programming or involvement as programming as a lot of people think. That's why we have a program council, but we do select half of the program council also, and they're the group that really makes recommendations to management about programming.
Well, and two, we've got a lot of good programming, and that we. There was a big shakeup, and everybody moved around here about a year ago. As far as the, of course, we stayed right where we are, but there was a lot of moving around. Can you address that? Has it been as successful as everybody talked about?
It did help some. Of course, it could help a lot more if we did more promotion outside of our current listeners, and that's one of the things we're trying to work on for this marketing plan. We're still sort of in the planning stages for most of this. We do go out a lot to events and pass out program schedules. In fact, we'll have some of our board members are going to be out before the Pride Parade this weekend on Saturday, before it gets dark, passing out program schedules, mostly probably to people on the other floats. And we do that for a lot of the parades, too. We'll pass them out before the parade start and other public events and sometimes even at parks and that sort of thing, like Discovery Green. But I was going to also, before I forget, mention that, you know, we have 24 members on our board. 12 of them are up for election this time. A quarter of those are staff, mostly unpaid staff programmers. But the others, there's 9 positions that are listener positions that are up for election this time. And several of those people are term limited or have chosen not to run again. So we need new people for those positions for sure. And our current members are up for re-election. You know, some of them may choose even not to run again. So it's a really good time to throw your hat in the ring if you're thinking at all about you know, putting in your put your efforts to help KPFT.
Well, Bill, okay, I'm out there in the audience. I've just heard what you said there. Now, what do I need to do?
Okay,
to run.
Okay, well, you can. The easiest thing, if you have internet access, is go to the website. You can go to kpft.org, look for the elections link, and click on that. You can go directly to pacificaelections2010.org, but it's easier just to remember kpft.org and click on the elections link, and that will take you to the national elections website. You can download a packet for, there's a section for prospective candidates, and there's lots of other information there. Pick the one for KPFT. The applications are all the same, or the packets are all the same, except for the name of the station. If you have questions, you can contact our local election supervisor, Kathy Kidd, and her her email address is there. Her phone number is there on the website. You can also just call the station during the day and leave her a message if you prefer to do that at 713-526-4000. And you can even email the LSB, all of us, and ask any questions you have, and we'll be glad to either refer you to her or ask any other questions about what it's like to being on the board, because we're all looking for good more new board members. You can email the local station board by emailing lsb@kpft.org.
Well, and to go back to what you said, I've either have volunteered over the last 12 months, ending the 30th of this month, 3 hours that are labeled, or I've written a check for at least $25 to be eligible to run, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Check or credit card. And if you just made a pledge during this last fund drive and you didn't pay by credit card, and if you have not yet received the paperwork for your pledge from KPFT, because that takes a little while for them all to be sent out, then you might want to call a membership office and go ahead and just give them a credit card number or send your check in before the 30th so that your membership will be up to date.
And if you're that interested, you can come down to the station with the check.
That's right. Exactly.
And, well, as we're wrapping up here, what else do you, is there anything we haven't talked about that you want to make sure we get covered?
Well, mostly just would like to encourage for all of your listeners and for your listeners to encourage their friends, somebody that they think would be a good board member, to please download the packet. You do have to, don't wait till the very last minute. It has to all be turned in by June 30th. One of the things you have to do is get at least 15 signatures from other members if you're a listener candidate, as well as filling out a few forms and completing a statement of why you want to run for the board and that sort of thing. It's a pretty easy little questionnaire. And there's Kathy Kidd, our local election supervisor, is organizing several petition signing parties and other events. And even if you don't have a internet connection, you know, you can listen for those. There'll be announcements. There's been some on the air already. And the there'll be petition forms available there and opportunities to get your petition signed by, you know, myself, other board members, and other people. We're all interested in getting, you know, new people, good people on the board who, you know, want to help KPFT.
Well, I want to thank you for your good work that you've done, and thank you for keeping us on the air. We like it here.
Well, we like Queer Voice. I like Queer Voices, and thank you so much for all that you do every week to keep all the great information, the great programming coming.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks.
This is Queer Voices.
Extra, read all about it, extra.
There are lots of ways to connect with your favorite international LGBT radio show online. You can review content summaries of each weekly program, read the text of news wrap, and see some of the faces behind the voices you hear at our website, www.thiswayout.org. Follow us on Twitter at TWO Radio. Read our blog at www.twopodcast.blogspot.com. And check out our fan page at facebook.com/thiswayoutradio.
We've reserved you a front row seat as the actors take their places for the penultimate scene of California's constitutional courtroom drama later in this half hour. Britain's new Conservative Party Prime Minister David Cameron delivered his LGBT Pride Month greetings to a gathering of invited community leaders on June 16th in the Rose Garden at No. 10 Downing Street. He also spoke on behalf of his government partner, Liberal Democrat Nick Clegg. The right-left coalition was born of a nearly unprecedented split election, and it seems to have pointed the Tories in what was already an increasingly more queer, supportive direction. Cameron's remarks at the outdoor reception were captured by a pink news reporter in the crowd.
First of all, a very big welcome to the gardens of No. 10 Downing Street. I'm very proud that I think this is the biggest Pride event that's ever happened in the gardens of No. 10 Downing Street. So it's great to have you all here. And I think it's important to remember that this summer isn't just about football, it's also about Pride. So welcome. I think Gordon's still here somewhere. Obviously, the coalition has come together. I make the joke about the civil partnership, but the coalition has come together, which I think is a really positive thing for British politics. And in our coalition agreement, there's some very clear commitments to making sure that we advance the cause of equality and equal rights and equal treatment for people who are lesbian or gay or transgender. It's very important that it's in the coalition agreement, and we're both going to push that forward. And I know, and I stand here as the leader of the Conservative Party, that has not always got this issue right, if I can put it that way. I was very clear about that at the Pride event last year, where I made clear what I now thought of Section 28. I don't need to say that all again. But what I do say is I know we didn't get this right in the past. I know that we were slow learners. I know that we had a long way to travel. But I'm proud of the fact that we have travelled a long way in terms of supporting civil partnerships, in terms of standing up for equal rights and for equal treatment. And I think that is very important. And during the last election, we did make, I think, some important commitments in terms of tackling homophobic bullying in schools, in terms of ending the absurdity and the wrongness of still having convictions for consenting homosexual behaviour still counting against people. We believe they should be treated as spent, the slate should be wiped clean. And I'm pleased to announce today that we're taking a further step, and I think a good step and a right step. And I say this as someone who believes in marriage, who believes in civil partnership, who believes in commitment. And that is to say that if religious organisations, if churches, if mosques, if temples want to have civil partnerships celebrated at religious places of worship, that should be able to happen. And we should make that happen. And of course, those organisations that don't want that to happen, they have their rights too, but we shouldn't let some legalistic nonsense get in the way of people who want to celebrate civil partnerships in churches and other churches who want that to happen. We should allow that to happen, and I think that would be an important step forward, and we're going to make sure that that does happen. I want to pay tribute to Nick and to the Liberal Democrats, who have campaigned very hard on these issues over many, many years. And in the spirit of being cross-party, I also want to pay tribute to the previous government. I said on the steps of No. 10 Downing Street, just before walking through the door, that the last government had made our country more tolerant, more compassionate, that the legislation on equal age of consent, the legislation on civil partnership and other laws, these were important step forwards for things that you shouldn't have to fight for, and that is equality and equal treatment and respect. I think the agenda now, yes, there are still legal barriers and things that we should discuss and talk about. But I think a lot of the agenda now is about culture. Because the truth is, we'll never really tackle homophobic bullying in schools, we'll never tackle homophobic issues in the workplace just by passing laws. It's culture change and behavioural change that is needed as well. And with that, could I also just pay tribute to the huge number of Conservative members of Parliament and candidates, and also members of the Cabinet who are here tonight. That's because we care about these issues, we want to make progress with these issues. And I know that if I slip up, or if I fall down, my consultant, who I think all of you know, is in the press office in No. 10 Downing Street, ready to beat me into shape, if ever I should be found wanting. So thank you, Michael is an absolute star, and it's great to have him here tonight. So you're very welcome. Please eat and drink and admire the beautiful flowers, none of which I'm afraid I had anything to do with. Welcome to this great Pride event, and also, as I said, this summer is not just about football, it's about pride, it's about you, it's about what you've achieved. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was British Prime Minister David Cameron addressing LGBT leaders celebrating Pride Month in the Rose Garden at No. 10 Downing Street. Cameron still has his queer critics. Neither he nor his equality minister, Theresa May, have made mention of real marriage equality. Activists are also looking for plans to repeal the ban on gay men donating blood and for a stronger statement on the treatment of LGBT asylum seekers.
Every actor worth his salt strives to be honest and true in his portrayals on the stage or screen. Hello, this is Ian McKellen, and that's exactly what This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine, does as well, right here on this station.
The question of whether or not the U.S. Constitution guarantees the right to marriage equality for gay and lesbian couples is now in the hands of a federal judge. Anchor Mark Miracle and reporter Christopher Martinez covered the story on the June 16th edition of Pacifica Radio's California Evening News.
California's ban on same-sex marriage violates the U.S. Constitution and discriminates against gay and lesbian couples. According to a lawyer for plaintiffs suing to overturn Proposition 8 in a federal courtroom, a lawyer for the defense says, "We don't need evidence because every society agrees that marriage is between a man and a woman." Those were some of the closing arguments in the first federal trial challenging a state ban on same-sex marriage. Lawyers made their cases in a packed courtroom in San Francisco. Christopher Martinez files this report from San Francisco.
All we're asking the court to do is ensure that we are protected under our Constitution like every American is supposed to be.
Jeffrey Zerillo is one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit Perry v. Schwarzenegger, a challenge to the ballot initiative that declared only a man and a woman can marry in California. He spoke briefly to reporters on his way into the federal district courtroom. Plaintiff Kristen Perry was also on hand, together with her partner, Sandra Steer.
For Chris and I, this case for us is about how we as Americans just want to be treated equally by our government and under the law. And today we'll be going to court with that very simple request.
It's a case that began more than a year ago. In January, each side presented evidence and witnesses in 3 weeks of hearings. John Lewis is with the group Marriage Equality USA. He and his husband, Stuart Gaffney, were plaintiffs in the earlier landmark state trial that allowed same-sex marriage in California, until it was overturned by Prop 8. They're celebrating their second wedding anniversary as one of the 18,000 lesbian and gay couples that legally married before voters passed Prop 8. Now Lewis is closely watching the federal trial.
At this trial, their tactics that date back from the Anita Bryant years, those tactics are being put to the test of evidence.
The evidence phase of the trial ended in January, and Wednesday, lawyers for each side made their case. Federal Judge Bon Walker opened proceedings by saying, "June is, after all, the month of weddings." Lawyer Theodore Olson presented arguments for the plaintiffs who want to overturn Prop 8. He says the trial has been a great education, leaving a record of evidence the same way trial courts established evidence that led to the Supreme Court ruling in Brown v. Board of Education, ending racially segregated schools. He says Proposition 8 violates the U.S. constitutional guarantees of equal protection and due process because it discriminates against lesbian and gay couples for no rational reason. San Francisco Deputy City Attorney Therese Stewart also argued against Prop 8, telling the judge San Francisco wants nothing more than to be able to treat all its citizens equally. During a break in the proceedings, she told reporters she was proud to be able to present San Francisco's piece of the argument.
I do think that it adds something to say that it not only hurts the individuals who are affected, but it hurts all of us when any group is stigmatized.
After a lunch break, lawyer Charles Cooper gave his closing argument for the supporters of Prop 8. He says without the marital relationship, society itself would come to an end. He told the judge the definition of marriage as between a man and a woman is ubiquitous and has been in every society for millennia. Judge Walker asked Cooper to move from the millennia to the 3 weeks in January when lawyers presented their evidence. What does the evidence show? Cooper replied, "Your Honor, you don't have to have evidence. It's in the cases." Referring to previous court cases on marriage, the surprised judge asked, "I don't have to have evidence?" Later, Walker asked why the defense only presented one witness if there's such universal agreement about marriage. Cooper said, "Just go back to your chamber and pull down any dictionary, and you'll find the same definition of marriage." The same goes for any book on the subject, Cooper added, unless it was written in the last 30 years. Cooper argued limiting marriage to a man and a woman furthers the state interest in channeling what he calls potentially procreative activity into a stable union where a child is raised by the man and woman who brought them into existence. Prop 8 lawyer Andrew Pugno raised that point during the last day of trial testimony in January.
The best thing for a child is to have both a mother and a father. It's a very simple proposition. And the only social relationship that can offer a mother and a father is a man and a woman.
Supporters of Prop 8 also argue that the voters of California have the right to define marriage. Opponents say Prop 8 is a case of a majority voting to take away a civil right from a minority. David Boies is one of the lawyers for the plaintiffs supporting gay marriage.
No vote can take away a constitutional right. That is why we have a constitution.
The trial record is now complete, and the legal arguments are finished. But for Stuart Gaffney, watching the trial on his second wedding anniversary, that was not the most important thing.
At the end of the day, it's going to come back to this is about love and marriage, and that's what we heard this morning.
Judge Vaughn Walker could rule on the case in the next few months, or even the next few weeks. Whichever side loses is all but certain to appeal, and the case is likely to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court. Reporting from the Federal District Courthouse in San Francisco, I'm Christopher Martinez.
And reporter Christopher Martinez has joined me now in the studio. Christopher, you covered much of the original testimony in the case in January, and then the closing arguments today. In your opinion, which side made the better case, the plaintiffs or the defendants?
Well, I have to say it was a very lopsided trial. I was there every day of testimony when they presented expert witnesses and evidence, and the plaintiffs challenging Prop 8 had a string of academic expert witnesses on the history of marriage and discrimination against lesbians and gays and sociologists and economists. The defense had two, or we're hearing now maybe one witness, because it sounds like one of the witnesses may not be admitted, actually. And in effect, the defense was saying, we don't need to prove a case. The plaintiffs need to prove a case. All we need to show is that voters reasonably, we're doing something reasonably related to an interest of the state. And that interest, as the plaintiff's lawyer put it, is channeling potentially procreative activity. Another related point that the lawyer made was that only a man and a woman can accidentally have a child. So we want those children to be in a marriage. Technically, I don't think that is factually correct. If we learned anything from the Octomom, even with the best medical technology, you can accidentally have a bunch of children, but they didn't hear that in court today. It seemed like a pretty lopsided case, but you can never predict how a judge will rule.
And the plaintiffs are making a case in the record, in the evidence that they presented, that even if the Judge Walker rules against them, they have a good basis for appeal.
That's exactly what they're doing. They've set the record of fact with those two or three weeks of testimony that they presented, and now this is the evidence that an appeals court will look at, because whoever wins this case, the loser is sure to appeal it to the federal appeals court for the Ninth Circuit, and whoever loses that will appeal it to the Supreme Court, and they're pretty likely to I think it's pretty likely the Supreme Court will take up the case. Ultimately, they'll have the records that were the evidence that was put on the record in this trial in San Francisco.
Our thanks to Mark Miracle and Christopher Martinez of Pacifica's California Evening News. Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. This week, Sherry Lund, Michelle Pleasant, and Sir Ian McKellen contributed program material. Thanks also to Mark Miracle, Christopher Martinez, and Pacifica Radio. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is supported by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and by you. Thanks. Log on to thiswayout.org to support our work, listen to our podcasts, read the text of this week's news wrap, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. Follow us on Twitter at TWO Radio. Read our blog at www.twopodcast.blogspot.com. And check out our fan page at facebook.com/thiswayoutradio. To receive our weekly program content email alert, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. for associate producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on Radio Phoenix, Phoenix, Arizona, 5KIX, Kangaroo Island, South Australia, WRUV, Burlington, Vermont, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT. You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 9 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles, and J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage, which is produced in Houston. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Falinski. On-air voices are Brian Levinka, Jennifer Renee, J.D. Doyle, Glenn Holt, Summer Iman, and Jack Falinski. For more information about tonight's program, including links to websites and organizations mentioned during the show, visit queervoices.org. And you can send email to jack@queervoices.org. Be sure to listen to KPFT every Sunday morning starting at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston, a Pacifica Foundation station. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
This year, the Pacifica Foundation, the parent organization of this station, is holding elections to seat boards of directors in each of the foundation's five signal areas. These local station boards help shape the direction of this station. Your vote makes a difference. Please note the date of record that closes eligibility for voting is coming up June 30th. The date of record is the time when new members must be on the rolls for this election. If you qualify as a staff member, this supersedes the listener category of membership. Please make sure to log your volunteer hours in station-designated forms and ensure your contact information is on file. Those wishing to be eligible to vote in the upcoming election must meet the June 30th deadline. Tune into this station for more on this important board election or visit PacificaElections2010.org for details. This is KPFT Houston.
This is a political alert from Pacifica Radio Network to you, our listeners and activists. Help keep KPFT alive with the diverse voices of our community by running for your local station board and voting for the listener candidates. Nominations are open for the 2010 local station board election. Please visit PacificaElections2010.org to request a nomination package. For more information, contact Kathy Kidd at LES_KPFT@Pacifica.org. Candidate nomination packages must be received by June 30th at midnight.
KPFT Houston.
KPFT has just completed our Spring 2010 membership campaign. If you were one of the many listeners who joined this drive, thank you very much. You've made a contribution to your community that is appreciated. It will go a long way to bringing you the great radio you've come to enjoy. Before you know it, your membership envelope will arrive in the mail. Don't forget to pay your pledge. The great feeling you get when you support KPFT feels even better once you drop that check in the mail. And if you missed your chance to join and support the news, music, and other great programming you hear each day, there's still time. Join online kpft.org and do your part, or call 713-526-4000 to make a pledge. Thanks again for your support. You do make a difference. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.